I have three definitions to read you this morning from the Urban Dictionary. The first, call out culture. Call out culture, also referred to as outrage culture, is a form of public shaming that aims to hold individuals and groups accountable for their actions by calling attention to behavior that is perceived to be problematic and usually on social media. Cancel culture. Cancel culture is a modern internet phenomenon where a person is ejected from influence or fame by questionable actions. It is caused by a critical mass of people who are quick to judge and slow to question. It is commonly caused by an accusation, whether that accusation has merit or not, and is a direct result of ignorance and communication technologies outpacing the growth in available knowledge of a person. The last, ghosting. Ghosting is when a person cuts off all communication with their friends or the person they're dating with zero warning or notice beforehand. You mostly see it avoiding friends' phone calls, social media activities, and avoiding them in public. And now here's a letter written to the advice column, Tell Me About It, replied to by Carolyn Hacks, the host. Dear Carolyn, I would like your perspective on a ghosting situation. I met Rose 4 years ago in college. We kept in touch even after she transferred to a different college and after I graduated and moved to DC. Despite a 6-year age difference, we've always gotten along and talked almost every day. Then, one day, 2 weeks ago, Rose stopped talking to me completely. She started by not answering my texts. I tried calling, emailing, Facebooking, even Instagramming a message with no response. I got worried, and I reached out to a mutual friend. He said she's fine and has maintained contact with him. I'm completely baffled. We didn't have a fight, and I can't think of a reason for Rose to cut me off like this. I miss her. We were supposed to go to a concert together later this summer, and I'm starting to think that might not happen. Do you have any advice? Signed, Wondering in Washington. Dear Wondering in Washington, not really, which is exactly the point and power of ghosting. You have no recourse. You just text and dwell and fret and twist yourself into progressively sadder knots. Full disclosure, I see ghosting and other silent treatment as weak, cowardly, and cruel, except when necessary to escape the dangerous relationships safely. By caring, we empower people to hurt our feelings. Ghosting abuses that power and thus accounts for some of the bigger holes in my compassion and empathy reservoir. So, Rose, someone capable of such an epic failure of maturity was going to let you down at some point, either over this mystery conflict or another more scrutable one, either by ghosting or by noisier means, either in the near future or the distant one. People who can't handle direct communication when they're upset about something also can't handle a close, long-term friendship.
Hello. About 20 years ago, I used to play this computer game, and it was like old-style computer game called the Oregon Trail. It might still be out there. Maybe some of you are familiar with it or you played it with your kids. It was really fun. You had to make your way. You know, you were like the wagon train going, and you could buy provisions. And along the way on the trail, there'd be people there, and you could click on them, and they would tell you stuff. And sometimes they'd say, you know, the river crossing, or watch out, there's, you know, problems on this thing, and, you know, useful things. But Sometimes the game was populated with people that just say, you know, simple things that weren't really that helpful to you. So you could just click them off. If they weren't interesting or helpful to you, you just click them off, make them go away. And I remember thinking about that, like, what are we teaching kids with this? That if somebody is not useful or interesting, you just make them go away. But I thought, you know, parents are modeling other types of behavior, so this was only one little part of their lives. And that was 20 years ago. Here we are now in 2020. Of course, we've evolved so much in those 20 years. The internet has really become a place where we see the best and the worst of human behavior. Especially in places where people can respond instantly with the emotions that are present for them. Twitter is a good example of that, but Facebook is not immune to it either. So let me go through some of the examples using the definitions that Molly shared of types of behavior we're seeing now on the internet. So call-out culture. This is the form of public shaming that aims to hold individuals or groups accountable for their actions by calling attention to a behavior that is perceived to be problematic. Well, not letting people get away with saying or doing inappropriate things or offensive things sounds like a good plan to me. Sounds great. Very satisfying in a public space with the benefit of anonymity in a lot of cases, calling out someone who's been racist or homophobic, misogynist. It's a version of the ultimate public square the internet is. Public shaming. It used to be that we would shame people hundreds of years ago by putting them in the stocks in the public square and everybody could throw things at them. But call-out culture is a version of that on the internet. But it's powerful because it's become a place where people can be heard who'd been previously silenced. Women who've been abused, people who've been subject to racist behavior, have a place where they can speak out with little repercussion. Of course, call-out culture is not just on the internet. It's now more and more in our lives, sometimes for good and sometimes not so good. A friend of mine told me about her interaction with an elderly man in a hotel where she was staying for a conference. She was waiting for he and his wife to get onto the elevator, and the man came on and his wife was coming farther, and he turned to my friend with a smile and said, "She moves a lot more slowly now that I've stopped beating her." And my friend looked at him and she said, "You're smiling, which indicates to me that you think that's funny, but it's not funny." You can imagine it was a bit of a chilly elevator ride down to the first floor. But of course, since call-out culture involves humans, it has a downside. It's often taken too far or done without consideration of the context of what someone has said. And we can all think of examples of that. So let's take it to the next level. Call out culture, you call out somebody who's said or done something that you consider inappropriate or offensive. Cancel culture. It's a modern internet phenomenon where a person is ejected from influence or fame by questionable actions. It's caused by a critical mass of people who are quick to judge and slow to question, commonly caused by an accusation, whether the accusation has merit or not. So cancel culture obviously follows call-outs and really came to a lot of energy during the Me Too era. The Me Too era when women started naming the abuse that they'd experienced. Primarily sexual abuse. Ever heard of Harvey Weinstein? Kevin Spacey? Al Franken? Garrison Keillor? You can name others, I'm sure. These people were canceled. Now, sometimes it appears justified, and sometimes not. But you know, it doesn't really matter because it's the judgment of the masses. Again, it's good that people are called out for behavior and stopped, from continuing, stop from having influence. But it can be bad when it's a mob action with little opportunity to reclaim. It's the 21st century of the public hanging in the public square. And it doesn't just happen to famous people. Maybe some of you will remember the story of Sarah Brosh, who was a former international human rights lawyer getting a PhD at Yale. In 2018, she called the police on a black student who was sleeping in a common area near her dorm room. The incident became known as napping while black. So the story spread online and was cut and dried. This was a racist woman who called the cops on a black woman who was doing nothing but sleeping in a student lounge. So the outcry was immediate. There was one activist who on Twitter had 200,000 followers who all called for Yale to take action, either to not only to expel her from the university, but to criminally charge her. The story was picked up by the national media, and anger continued to mount. Brosh ended up fleeing her home, and nearly 3,000 people signed a petition demanding that she be removed from campus. While a complaint against her was ultimately withdrawn, she lost her housing, her reputation, and now needs special permission to visit campus. Did the punishment fit the crime? How many of you have clicked on a story on Facebook about some outrageous behavior of someone, or shared a tweet, or passed judgment in your own mind based on only the evidence that you see in the outraged cancel culture presentation? So after someone's been canceled, can they come back? Can they get uncanceled? Maybe. Maybe they can. Michael Jackson probably should have been canceled, but maybe not. His legacy seems to have survived his crimes. Garrison Keillor, I don't even know what his crimes really were. I know that he disappeared and he came back, and the whole thing makes me really uncomfortable. Can I support him? Should I read his posts? I think the more talented the person, or the more we like the person's artistic presentation, the more we're able to tolerate their misbehavior. It's really complicated. The moral question we ask ourselves is, can we appreciate the artistry of someone flawed who has done damaging things to people? If Hitler were a great artist, would his paintings be beautiful? Or would they be forever tainted by his life and the choices that he made and the damage that he did? Now, of course, the answer is different for everyone. There are dimensions to our moral code, and some people have a higher level on the purity dimension. So they feel that if someone had done something bad, they're uncomfortable with any other aspect of their behavior. Others of us are able to tolerate the complexity of someone who's done bad things but makes beautiful art or beautiful music. This is the challenge of living with the complexity of our humanity. Humans can be brilliant and destructive, all in the same person, and sometimes at the same time. So what is it about our psychology that we often feel compelled to engage in canceling someone? One piece of it is what's called confirmation bias. This is our tendency to seek out and confirm our current attitudes with new information, confirm the way we already think. So if we already don't like some celebrity and then we read about something that they've done, it just confirms what we've already known. You know the phrase well, I never liked her anyway. But the most powerful aspect of what makes us be involved in cancel culture-like activities is tribalism. The power of the group runs strong in our instincts, strong in our humanness. We are wired this way. And in cancel culture, we bond together with a group to shut someone out. The influence, of course, is tremendously magnified by being part of that group. Our influence is magnified. It's so easy to get drawn into this. It doesn't really even need the internet to be called into that tribal place where someone is made outside. High school, anyone? People can abandon their reason and morality and act cruelly if they are a part of a large group of people behaving in the same manner, especially if they feel some cohesion with that group. We lose our moral compass. And then there's ghosting. This is up close and personal canceling with the added benefit of not even telling the person that they've been canceled. The lowest level of this, of course, is to unfriend someone on Facebook. And Facebook makes it really easy. That person will never know that you unfriended them. Ghosting is the topic of many advice columns, from not only the person doing the ghosting, wondering if ghosting is okay, to the person who has been ghosted, like the letter to Carolyn Hacks that Molly shared with you. I want to repeat Carolyn Hacks' word about ghosting because I think she says it so succinctly. I see ghosting as weak, cowardly, and cruel, except when necessary to escape dangerous relationships safely. By caring, we empower people to hurt our feelings, and ghosting abuses that power and thus accounts for some of the biggest holes in my compassion and empathy reservoirs. It's really quite seductive to exit a difficult relationship by just slipping out the back door. Just jump on the bus, Gus. But it's cowardly and weak and can be cruel. This happens with organizations as well. You're very active and involved, people feel connected and engaged, and then poof, it's like you were never there. I remember years ago when I was a member of this congregation and really brand new to the group, I'd agreed to participate in some, I was going to help out with something, some kind of event here, like many of you do. And the day of it, I kind of forgot. And then I kind of wanted to pretend like I forgot, even though I really didn't forget. And I kind of thought I didn't feel very well, and I kind of didn't want to do it. So I didn't show up. And I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone, telling her about it, and she said, "Oh, well, I guess you'll have to find another church." Of course, I did confess, and I was forgiven and re-brought into the community. Now, none of this call out, cancel, ghosting, none of this is new. But somehow it feels a lot more alive and engaged right now. I don't know whether these behaviors have increased, or we're just aware of them more, or because we engage with them in social media, they have a different energy. But no doubt, the world is more complex. There is a new online public square where engaging in negative attitudes and behaviors has less repercussions than it would if we had to look each other in the face. So there's this Chinese adage many of you, I'm sure, have heard, "May you live in interesting times." So congratulations. How do we navigate in this complex world? I've listed just a few types of complex behaviors where we have to make choices. We have to navigate in this complexity. So I want to encourage you to think about developing your moral compass. Now, you probably have one, but you might not be intentional about it, about developing it and cultivating it. I say take your time to develop your moral compass. Find what points you, what behaviors point you towards the most life-affirming behavior. Most of our moral judgments come instantly. They're based on our DNA and our upbringing. And so calibrating your moral compass means balancing those things, balancing your instinct, balancing your intuition, your emotion, your reason, all of those play a part. So how do you go about calibrating your moral compass? Self-reflection. Pay attention to your immediate reactions to things, particularly when they're really strong, and take a little time to act. Practice humility. Have people in your life whose moral compass you respect, and they can help guide you and help you calibrate your own. Find spiritual practices that encourage compassion and gratitude. Practice meditation, mindfulness. And come here. Come here. We strive together. We come together each Sunday to recalibrate our own moral compasses with what's most important and just. We come here so you can be accepted for just who you are, wonderful and beautiful and human. When I was writing this, though, I realized that I don't really need to convince you to work on your moral compass. You've already signed up by showing up here, by being a part of this community, by committing to our principles, to the principles of Unitarian Universalism. And if you're new here today, I want to say, welcome to our moral compass calibration. And you can get a bookmark out at the welcome table that lists the 7 principles. When you look at those principles, most people go, yeah, I don't disagree with any of these. But the challenge really is living into them. Meg Barnhouse, the minister at the Austin, Texas Church, writes this article that I share in the Exploring class on principles. The title of the article is, Who Says the Principles Are Easy? Because she recommends that we try to live into the principles by every one of them at the end, we say, in our hearts and in our homes and in our congregations. So the inherent worth and dignity of every person in our homes and in our congregations. Justice, equity, and compassion in our homes and in our congregations. And I would challenge you to add in how we live our lives in the world, in how we treat other people. An excellent set for your moral compass. This idea of calibrating your moral compass and using it to guide your life really comes down to emotional maturity. Honoring your emotions, but not letting them rule your life. We see that in our world right now, people letting their emotions rule their lives, and it's not a pretty sight. It's not a helpful thing for the person or for our world. And emotional maturity combined with thoughtfulness and reason equals wisdom. So when you think about applying your moral compass to a challenge that comes your way, I encourage you to take your time. Give your emotions and your reason equal space to duke it out. Take responsibility for the actions that you have done. Here's a couple of easy first steps. Give people the benefit of the doubt. I can't really say that enough. Give people the benefit of the doubt. Don't react out of your emotions without a good check on your compass. And don't buy into groupthink without some personal reflection. We come together to deepen our lives and be a force for healing in the world. Our mission here at UUSS. So how is this idea of using your moral compass a part of healing the world? By making good choices, you're making a difference. But also, more importantly, you're modeling this behavior. We need people to model thoughtful, mature behavior. It makes a difference. By being a person who has a good moral compass, you can stand in the swirl of complexity and take time to choose a path that affirms life and interconnection. But I think the most important thing I want to say to you today, if you only remember one thing, I want to say to you, the most important thing you can do is to be a decent person. It's really an old-fashioned word. Listening to the impeachment trials, there were moments of decency, and I just thought my body and my heart were going to sing with joy at the presence of decency. Be a decent person. It's exactly what the world needs right now. So may it be. Blessed be.